May it please the court, counsel, Alan Epstein, representing Ronald Walker and Walker Development. With me at counsel table is David Leavenworth, also representing the defendants. I will first address the easy issues, and Mr. Leavenworth will then address the more difficult ones. Defendant's contention on appeal is that plaintiffs had no viable cause of action against them under the circumstances of this case, under any theory of liability, not for breach of contract, not for the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and not for fraud. With respect to the breach of contract claim against Walker Development, the jury was instructed on breach of contract based on subparagraph 6 of the agreement, although plaintiffs also rely on paragraph 24 throughout the pretrial and trial proceedings. Assuming the jury followed its instructions, it would have considered plaintiff's breach of contract claim pursuant to subparagraph 6, and then considered both provisions in the context of plaintiff's breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing claim. But neither provision can serve as the basis of the cause of action under either theory. So paragraph 6 was the first right to buy provision relating to a hayfield at 3 lots owned by Walker Development that was not part of the development that had originally been sold to plaintiffs. The 3 lots comprised a small portion of the property. Walker sold to Holcim 3.5 years after selling the development to plaintiffs. Holcim bought the 3 lots and an additional 270 some acres, 285 acres, all of which was adjacent to the development. Nobody purchased the hayfield, that is still owned by defendants, and the entirety of the property is depicted in Plaintiff's Exhibit 27. Plaintiff's breach of contract theory based on subparagraph 6 fails for several reasons, assuming that Walker did not give a right of first buy to plaintiffs with respect to those 3 lots. First, plaintiff's damages theory is that the development lost future profits because of Walker's sale of the entirety of the property to Holcim, not 3 lots. Under plaintiff's theory of the case, plaintiff would have sustained the same damages even if Walker had sold plaintiffs those 3 lots. And plaintiff introduced no evidence flowing from the alleged failure to give plaintiff a first right to buy the lots. Plaintiff's damages theory was based not on what they would have gained had they been offered and purchased those lots. They did not allege that, for example, that if they had been offered the lots, they would have purchased them and the lots would have increased in value. Plaintiff's damages theory was that Holcim's purchase of the property impacted the marketability of the development, which plaintiff already owned. That damage didn't occur because plaintiffs weren't offered the 3 lots. Finally, plaintiff did not establish that it would have even purchased or could have purchased the lots had Mr. Walker offered them. In response to the question what he would have done had Walker offered the lots to him, Mr. Jenkins responded, "I would have said prove it because I think that $3,750,000 is about $3 million more than his purchase was worth," referring to the entirety of the property that Holcim had purchased.
Mr. Epstein, let me ask you a question. Are the arguments that you're making now about damages, are those sufficiency of the evidence arguments, or are they legal arguments that somehow the legal theory itself is not sustainable as a matter of law? I'm kind of confused as to what your argument is here.
I'm arguing that the legal theory underlying plaintiff's claim that the breach of contract by not offering the 3 lots was not supported by any evidence of a causal link to damages. So I think it's a mixed question of fact and law. As a matter of law, plaintiff didn't prove that any damages flowed from the failure to offer the 3 lots.
Okay, so can you point me where in the record at trial you made this argument?
There was a motion for directed verdict made.
On this particular issue where you articulated this issue?
The trial attorney made the argument that in the context of plaintiff's introduction of evidence of the value of the property, that the damages that he was being alleged as the result of the failure to sell the three lots there was no causal link to what damage was alleged, which objection was overruled, that is in our brief. I can't tell you which page that's on.
So
then there was a motion for directed verdict made twice.
On this issue?
On the issue of whether plaintiffs could sustain a breach of contract claim as a matter of law.
Okay.
There was an argument made incorporating the motion for summary judgment. There wasn't a prolonged or extended articulation of the argument at halftime or at the close of defendant's case in chief, but trial counsel made reference to the motion for summary judgment.
Thank you.
With respect to the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing, the duty of good faith and fair dealing only applies when one party has discretionary authority to determine certain terms of the contract, such as quantity, price, or time. Discretion occurs when the parties at contract formation defer a decision regarding performance terms of the contract. Liability for breach of the duty obtains when that party does not exercise that discretion in good faith. Neither paragraph 24 nor subparagraph 6 invested any discretion in Walker Development. Paragraph 24 provided that Walker Development assumed responsibilities for previous phases of the development and to provide a written guarantee within 90 days of the close of the contract that it had assumed those responsibilities. This provision involved no discretion as to quantity, price, or time, or any other condition that would occur in the future, and plaintiff introduced no evidence that Walker Development did not complete previous phases of the development. It did. Subparagraph 6, gave plaintiff a first right to purchase. Defendant either gave that right or didn't. The parties disputed whether this occurred, but that provision involved no discretion on the part of Walker Development.
Counsel, does that provision allow some discretion to Walker as to the manner of the offer of first refusal?
No, it just says that seller will give a first right to buy the three lots in the hayfield. There was nothing discretionary about it.
But it doesn't address, for example, when the offer should occur, how many days or weeks before the sale, or whether it should occur in writing or orally. It doesn't address any of those issues.
No, it doesn't. But it's not that kind of... Well, implicitly, it would be before the offer was made to anyone else. But no, there's no explicit time frame within which the offer should be made. But I think that's kind of boilerplate contract language that the offer would be made prior to it being offered to another party.
Pardon me, counsel. Someone has an electronic device that is impeding our recording. If you have a BlackBerry or something like that, please put it into airplane mode and turn it off. Thank you. Well, I have a question, and I don't know if this is better directed to you or to your co-counsel, but I'm having difficulty understanding the bid process and whether this is with respect to Walker's counterclaim, right, with respect to the paying off the water tap needs, and whether they were taken into account in the bid that was made by the bank. Is that better addressed to your co-counsel?
Yes,
I will do so.
Yeah. But again, there was no...
We're still getting the feedback. Maybe someone has a device on near a microphone.
If it's on at all, turn it off. Any kind of device.
And don't worry, we paused our time while you were doing that. You can move in.
But even if that invested, if that provision, because it was open-ended, left some discretion as to the timing of when the first right to buy had to be extended, there was still no evidence that the failure to do so resulted in any damage. So for the same reason plaintiff's breach of contract claim failed, the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing claim failed as well. And because there was no special verdict form, it's not possible to determine which of those two provisions, paragraph 24, subparagraph 6, the jury relied on, if they did, to render a breach of the good faith and fair dealing claim. So at a minimum, I'd argue that the defendant would be entitled to a new trial. Plaintiff's fraud claim also fails as a matter of law. First, assuming the viability of plaintiff's breach of contract claim, if it was viable, we'd argue that the economic loss rule bars plaintiff's fraud claim against Walker Development. The underlying premise of plaintiff's fraud claim is that Walker applied to rezone his property without disclosing the option to Holcim, which would have subjected him to a breach of contract claim by Holcim because of the confidentiality provision in that agreement, and then sold the property to Holcim, which then impacted the marketability of the development. This is the same theory underlying plaintiff's breach of contract claim, and the same damages theory was the lost profits under both the breach of contract and the fraud claim. But more importantly, plaintiff's fraud claim fails as a matter of law and its merits. Plaintiff's fraud theory was that when Walker applied for the zone change, he did not disclose the plaintiff the Holcim option and instead told him he was going to put his property into a conservation easement. Plaintiff's theory was that if he and other residents in the development knew about the option, they would have successfully petitioned the commissioners to deny the change in the first instance. Assuming the validity of that attenuated fraud theory, defendants must still have owed plaintiff a legal duty to disclose the option. Under the Malin Oil case, the defendant must owe the plaintiff the duty of disclosure for the plaintiff to be able to maintain a fraud claim. At the time, defendants executed the option with Holcim over 3 years after the sale of the development, they were in no relationship with plaintiff, fiduciary, business, or otherwise. Defendants had the legal right to seek a zone change, and they had a legal right to sell their property to whomever they wanted. They owed plaintiff no duty to disclose their option with Holcim. By analogy, if I told my next-door neighbor that I was going to sell my house to some people who planned to tastefully remodel it, but then sold it to a developer who intended to scrape it and build an ugly tract home that would diminish property values in the neighborhood, I may be a bad neighbor, but you can't sue me for fraud. That is really not a stretch from plaintiff's fraud theory in this case. Defendant had a right to seek his own change and a legal right to sell the property to whomever they wanted. The zoning category that defendant sought conditionally permitted mining. I probably wouldn't want to be living next door to a mine, a property on which a mine can be built. My recourse would be to seek administrative or legislative relief, not to sue a neighbor who legally sold his property to a mining company. And defendants request that the court reverse and remand with directions to dismiss plaintiff's complaint and to direct the trial court to award Walker Development attorney fees under the contract's prevailing party attorney fee provision, as well as attorney fees incurred on appeal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Leavenworth. I represent Walker Development and Ronald Walker. I'm going to address the counterclaim, and I will address your question, Judge Carey. And I'm also going to address the calculation of prejudgment interest and the second, the appeal in the second lawsuit.
Then if I may, let me just sort of tell you what my question is. It is unclear to me from the record how, whether the bid was taken into account. I can't tell if Walker got some benefit with respect to the payoff of the liens, either in the bank's bid or how that got calculated in. That's very unclear to me from the record. I don't know if there was some deduction that was made in the bidding process. Can you please address that? And I can clarify more if you would like.
No, I believe I understand your question. And in part, I don't know the answer to your question. Whether the bank bid a deficiency in its underlying bid, I am unsure. I would point out, however, that I don't believe it matters at all. And I'll get to the answer to your question in a second here, if I may proceed. The issue here in the counterclaim is fundamentally whether the court erred in finding that Walker Development stood in the shoes of the bank, that is the underlying foreclosing bank that foreclosed its deed of trust, its first deed of trust, when it commenced the foreclosure, from which Walker Development redeemed. The answer to that question is fairly simple, and I think it addresses your question and the reason it doesn't matter. The rights of the parties, that is to say, the rights of a foreclosing lender under first deed of trust, as the bank was, and the rights of a redeeming party are fundamentally different. A foreclosing party is, by definition, required to take into account the super priority liens that existed in this case.
They may or may not, actually. There's a couple of different ways they can bid it. They can bid it to just not pay any attention to it at all, because the lender can bid just, the bank could have bid just the amount of the bank's debt without respect to the water tap liens at all, right?
That's correct. But then they couldn't collect a deficiency.
Right. Or they could have bid the fair market value minus the amount of the water tap liens, right?
That's correct. In which
does the record show any? I didn't see anything in the record that shows which they did.
Nor did I, and I don't know the answer to that question. But as I said, I don't believe it matters, because Walker Development, as a redeeming party, only had the option to bid an amount equal to or greater than the bid of a third party that actually took the property at sale for, in this case, $350,000. Walker's bid was required to be that $350,000 plus the costs accrued to that point by the public trustee, for a total of $352,000. I believe the better question, Judge Terry, is whether the third party bidder took into account the value of the liens when it bid the property. I think it is Topperdale's position that they presume, and or they should be presumed to have taken into account that value when they bid it. And frankly, they may have. But the point is, we don't know. And the more important point is that what the case law requires of the trial court is to determine the fair market value at the time of redemption. It's not determined by the price paid by that third party, in this case $350,000. What that $350,000 figure goes to and is important for is the question of what Walker's deficiency will be on its notes and its claims. And it is a consideration, and could be, and it goes to a point that I'll skip to the end of what I wanted to discuss with respect to this counterclaim, and that is the question addressed by counsel of whether there was a double recovery created by allowing the, in this case, Walker Development, to bring, or would have been a double recovery, to allow Walker Development to bring a counterclaim seeking recovery for the United States liens. And the issue doesn't go to whether Walker Development had the right to do so, although I think that's what Topperdale would like people to think. The issue goes rather to whether Walker Development would get a double recovery because someone incorrectly calculated what the extent to which his deficiency should be reduced by the fair market value of the property. But the fair market value of the property is not established by that bid. It should be independently established by the court.
So let me see if
the court never got there.
Let me see if I understand your position. Are you saying that whether the amount of the tap liens was taken into account or not doesn't impact whether Walker has the right to raise its counterclaim? It might be a defense once it raises the counterclaim, but it doesn't tell you whether it can raise the counterclaim or not.
Correct. It's a defense to the amount of the deficiency that Walker could collect. The fair market value of the property has to be considered in Walker's recovery on any claim for recovery under the water liens or the tap liens. And, you know, I think it's also important to in looking at this counterclaim, to recognize that the trial court issued its order originally on the idea that the super liens didn't survive foreclosure. The trial court then reversed its position and gave another opinion, essentially saying that the super liens did survive foreclosure, and I think that was correct. But that's when it took the position that it stood in the shoes of the bank, which I think is incorrect, because the redeeming party stands in a very different position. The other point I'd like to just address quickly with respect to the counterclaim is Top Rail's argument that the deed of trust provision in Section 9 that provides that Top Rail has the right to bring suit and add to its note debt certain costs that it might incur trying to cure breaches of the deed of trust contract are can't apply. And Top Rail suggests the analogy that, for example, it would be ridiculous to consider that Walker Development would have a right to sue Top Rail for not paying insurance premiums after the foreclosure had occurred and Top Rail or Walker Development had taken ownership of the property. Well, the problem with that argument, although somewhat appealing as an analogous circumstance, is that it's a false hypothetical. Had, for example, Top Rail failed to pay insurance premiums before the foreclosure when it owned it, and had Walker Development later been required to pay those in a lawsuit or otherwise, it would have had the same rights it would have with respect to the lien under the contract. That is, it would have had the right to recover insurance premiums. The tax liens, the reason it's a false analogy is the tax liens were accrued and allowed to be imposed on the property by Top Rail before it lost possession of the property. I think the briefs are reasonably clear that, and I won't go into great detail about them, but or repeat them here. But I think the issue, in part, or a good part of the issue, is whether the deed of trust was extinguished. That has been Top Rail's point of view. They say it was extinguished by the foreclosure first, and they indicate that they think it was extinguished by merger, by the doctrine of merger, because it's a lesser estate. I think in both instances they're incorrect. The lien of the deed of trust clearly is extinguished, but the Colorado cases are clear in a number of instances that a deed of trust should be viewed as a contract and can stand alone as a contract and be enforced. I can't tell you or point you to a case where this provision of the deed of trust was subsequently enforced, but other provisions of deed of trust have been enforced after foreclosure, and in some instances after the deed of trust is released as a contract. I'd like to speak briefly about the prejudgment interest question. The parties disagreed on the application of prejudgment interest and briefed it to the court on whether prejudgment interest should be applied beyond the contract claim, that is to say, should it be applied to lost profits. The trial court held that no, it cannot be applied to lost profits, and issued an order. It was part of an order on several motions
an order instructing how prejudgment interest should be applied. It basically took the position that prejudgment interest should be applied to the $567,000 verdict that the jury had originally returned, because that was out-of-pocket expenses and not lost profits. The court erred in three ways, in our view. First, it erred by applying that prejudgment interest to a verdict that the court itself eliminated. Although there's no case in Colorado that states this, there's an analogous case with respect to prejudgment or to, with respect to interest on personal injury claims. It's Oka v. Vered, and we believe its rule and principle should be applied here, and that is that the trial court doesn't have the discretion to apply prejudgment interest to an amount other than what is contained in a judgment. The judgment for $567,000 to which the court applied that prejudgment interest was in fact eliminated by the court as duplicative. It should have been applied, in our view, to the $500,000 judgment only. The other error, very briefly, was that it added $5,000 to the $567,000 that the evidence tended to show was based or constituted out-of-pocket expenses. It added $5,000 on the theory that because the experts' reports occurred about a year prior to trial, there must have been some additional out-of-pocket expenses incurred. And that may or may not be the case. I think the error occurs because there simply is no evidence in the record that there was $5,000 of additional out-of-pocket expenses incurred during that year. The more important error, and the one that I believe to be more egregious, is probably not the fault of the trial court. The trial court directed directed Top Rail to calculate prejudgment interest, and it told it to do it on the contract sums of $567,000. Top Rail proceeded to calculate interest on the entire tort claim and then subtract the remaining amount of prejudgment interest that it couldn't, that shouldn't be applied on the contract claim. It's a reverse calculation, the effect of which was to apply prejudgment interest on the contract claim to Ronald Walker individually, but Ronald Walker was not a party to the contract to which prejudgment interest should apply. Moving very quickly into the question of the second appeal, I'm going to assume that the court knows the facts of this case, but I want to point out that the case was filed 10 months after the original case. It's a case, and obviously we're here today because it's in the same court before the same trial court, same trial judge. There is a threshold issue that may mean that the court doesn't even need to consider the second appeal, and that is the idea that if Walker Development prevails on its appeal with respect to the counterclaim or the other matters, there simply cannot be claim preclusion applied in the second lawsuit. There's no Colorado case on this point. I can find no law. However, there is law in other jurisdictions. There is law out of the United States Supreme Court. Butler v. Eaton, followed in a number of jurisdictions, establishes the rule that I believe the court should adopt here, and that is that a second judgment based upon the preclusive effects of the first judgment should not stand if the first judgment is reversed. Top Rail contends that the preclusive effect of the judgment in the first case should stand and allow the second lawsuit to, the grant of summary judgment in the second lawsuit to stand, notwithstanding reversal. And we believe that's wrong. I'd like to speak quickly to the extent I can, to two points in the substance and merits of the case in the second lawsuit. The most important one is that there is, in order for there to be res judicata, there must be no genuine issue of fact and dispute. With respect to final judgment, Judge Marshall's own order states that the question of satisfaction of the underlying debt is arguable. She describes it as arguably satisfied. I submit that that is not a standard by which summary judgment can issue. And with that, I think I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Greg O'Boyle, attorney registration number 29008, and I represent the appellees in this action, Top Rail Ranch Estates LLC and Chris Jenkins. This appeal involves defendant's attempt to reverse a jury's verdict in favor of Top Rail at the conclusion of a five-day jury trial. Top Rail owned a residential subdivision that it purchased from Walker Development. Walker Development and its principal, Ron Walker, owned property next, they each owned property next to the subdivision. And Walker Development's property was located in the view corridor for Top Rail's subdivision. Walker Development and Ron Walker breached its contractual obligations, and Walker Development and Ron Walker committed fraud in order to ensure the sale of their property to a mining company for $3.7 million. Because the jury was properly instructed, the jury's verdict should be affirmed by this court, and there were no objections to those jury instructions. First of all, I'd like to address the question of whether Walker Development preserved the question on the breach of contract and the issues regarding the breach of contract. Once trial begins, motions for summary judgment effectively become moot. And this proposition is found in the case of Fire, Collison, and Kilmer versus Jones, 926 P. Second, 1244, Colorado, 1996. This case requires that Walker had to renew any prior motion that it had made or make a new motion. It did neither. In their briefing, they point to two separate places in the record where they claim to have preserved this issue. First, they claim that Walker's trial counsel's statement when it made a motion for a directed verdict on different grounds of, "I think you understand the gist of our defenses and motions previously." They claim that that is an incorporation by reference of their previous motions. However, this statement is not a renewal of the motion. It's not an incorporation by reference of the prior motions. And the courts did not understand it to be a renewal of those prior motions. There was no ruling on this issue, and the trial, and there was no response from counsel for Top Rail on this issue. The second statement in the record relied upon by Walker is the statement made by Walker Development's trial counsel at the close of the evidence, and it's this statement: "I believe that we're entitled to directed verdict on that as well, as contract-based." This statement refers to the duty of good faith and fair dealing as a contract-based claim. And if you look at the transcript from pages 3015 through 3017, it's clear that Walker Development's counsel is simply making it clear that the duty of good faith and fair dealing was a contract-based claim. There was no attempt to preserve this issue. The trial court did not rule on this issue or ever understand that there was a renewal of this motion or a motion on the grounds that are found in the briefing. Therefore, the arguments that are being made by Walker Development at this time can only be considered a sufficiency of the evidence argument. And With respect to the breach of contract and the option provision in subparagraph 6, the evidence at trial showed that the option property was at the entrance to the subdivision. This was important property. The reason that there was a first right to purchase this property in the first place is because it was important property at the entrance of the subdivision, and there was no question that Walker Development, as the developer of this subdivision in the first place, and knowing that the sign where traffic came through and the sign where people saw what the subdivision was on this option property. And there's no question that Walker Development would have reasonably anticipated that if it didn't offer this property for sale to Top Rail, that Top Rail would be damaged. And Top Rail was damaged. And jury instruction number 37 states, you may award these damages if you find that they were a natural and probable consequence of the defendant's breach of contract and the defendant reasonably could have foreseen at the time the parties entered into the contract that the damages would probably have occurred if he breached the contract. There was no objection to this instruction or any of the other instructions. This issue went to the jury, and the jury found for the plaintiff on this issue. With respect to the amount of the damages, this is also within the jury's sole discretion. And I would cite the court to Avery versus Walmart Stores, Inc., 265 P3rd 456, and Durden versus Cheyenne Mountain Bank at 98 P3rd 899. And this concept is contained in jury instruction number 39, which states difficulty or uncertainty in determining the precise amount of any damages does not prevent you from deciding an amount. You should use your best judgment on the evidence. And this instruction is based on CJI instruction number 5:6. Walker Development did not object to this instruction. Because the amount of the damages is an issue that went to the jury, and it was a hotly contested issue at trial, and the jury awarded Top Rail damages and were proven, the jury's verdict on the breach of contract claim should be affirmed. With respect to the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, first it should be noted that the damages on this breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing are duplicative of the breach of contract damages. Therefore, the court doesn't even need to get to this issue if it chooses not to. With respect to the issue raised by the defendant that you can't tell from the jury's verdict which of the two paragraphs in the contract the jury was referring to, there was no objection by the defendants with respect to the jury instruction that was provided to the jury. Therefore, defendants agreed to that instruction. To the extent you can't tell which provision the jury was relying on in that verdict, that issue was waived when they allowed the jury to be instructed in that manner. With respect to the fraud claim, Walker and Walker Development waived its argument regarding the duty and made no argument that Walker and Walker Development did not owe a duty to Top Rail. They did argue at trial the economic loss rule, and the fact that the economic loss rule, they argued, bars Top Rail's fraud claim.
Can you go back just one second?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell me how they waived their argument regarding the claim that there was no duty.
By not raising that issue, they did not raise the issue of duty at trial, Your Honor. The argument is they incorporated by reference their prior motion for summary judgment, and actually, in this case, it would have been a reply to the motion for summary judgment because the motion itself didn't even raise the issue of duty. It was the reply that addressed that issue.
Okay.
And that's the only argument that they make. And the arguments, there's just nothing in the record where they argue that Walker Development did not owe Top Rail a duty, or that Mr. Walker individually did not owe Top Rail a duty.
Thank you.
With respect to the economic loss rule, the misrepresentation at issue here was in connection with the zone change application. And Walker's counsel, in closing argument, the trial counsel said, nothing in the contract prohibits or is intended to prohibit Walker Development Company or Walker from filing a zone change application on the premises no matter where it lay. This is an admitted fact by the plaintiff. And it's true, there's nothing in the contracts that addressed zone change applications or what Walker could or could not do with respect to zone change applications. And Top Rail doesn't contend that there are any contractual duties regarding the zone change application. The duty arose when Mr. Walker decided to talk to Mr. Jenkins and tell him that the reason for the zone change was he wanted to put his property into a conservation easement, when the real reason for the zone change was so that he could comply with his contract with the mining company, Holcim, to sell his property to the mining company. And a prerequisite to that contract and the closing on that contract was this zone change. And if the zoning didn't get changed, Walker stood to lose $150,000 that had already been paid to him prior to that zone change occurring. I'd now like to address the counterclaim. The trial court properly dismissed the counterclaim. With respect to the facts and how the bid occurred, a third party bid at the foreclosure step. And when that third party bid, it is presumed that third party would have taken into consideration these prior liens. These prior liens were already recorded against the property.
All right, so what authority do you have? I understand that you cited the DeCue case in the trial court. The DeCue case, from my view, doesn't have anything to do with this, because the DeCue case was a deficiency case. And in the DeCue case, the bank made a bid and then at the foreclosure sale and then tried to recover a deficiency from the debtors. The debtors claimed that there wasn't a deficiency and that the bid was not made in good faith. And the division of the Court of Appeals said there's a presumption that the bank made the bid in good faith. What does that have to do with whether anybody took into account the water tap liens in this case? And is there any evidence in the record as to whether those liens were taken into account in the bid in this case?
The third party that bid at the foreclosure sale did not testify at the foreclosure sale.
Or in your trial.
Excuse me. Yeah, okay. did not testify at trial. And okay. There's no evidence of what he was thinking. But Colorado favors finality in transactions. And that bidder who bid at the foreclosure sale, he and any other bidder who bids at a foreclosure sale would not have been able to go after Top Rail for these water tap liens that encumber the property.
Unless they had a contract that said they could.
And I understand, if they had a contract that said they could, and if that contract provided that the reason that they could was something other than to protect their security interest. And the reason, if you look at paragraph 9 in the deed of trust, the reason that paragraph is entitled Protection of Lender's Security. And it provides that the lender can do a lot of things as is necessary to protect its security. And if for example, these water tap liens, there's additional property that Walker Development still has a deed of trust on, because this was a partial foreclosure. as is pointed out. And if these water tap liens would have related to that other property that they didn't, that Walker Development didn't end up owning, then Walker Development would have, and the trial court would have said, yes, you can go to the jury with this claim because that's a valid claim. You haven't foreclosed on that property. You provided a benefit to Top Rail. Therefore, you can pursue these amounts.
I think I understand your position, counsel. Why isn't this just something that's available as a defense once the counterclaim gets asserted? Why does it block the counterclaim?
Because what
I understand your position that the deed of trust is dissolved, and that's refuted by a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1968 called Schwab versus Martin. So why isn't this just a defense to the counterclaim?
Because a redeeming party or a first lender, they neither one of them has a right to, once they're the owner of the property, to pursue any amounts that they spend on the property with respect to the property after the foreclosure sale.
Do you have any authority for the proposition you just stated?
Well, 38-38-106 is the statute with respect to first lenders.
Mm-hmm.
And 38-38-106 requires first deed of trust holders to take into consideration prior liens when they bid at a foreclosure sale.
Not if they only bid the amount of their debt.
Right.
They have options,
in which case, right. In which
and so
case,
we don't know which they did in this instance.
Well, in this case, the first deed of trust holder did bid in the entire amount of their bid. There was no deficiency. A third party came in and
the entire amount of their debt?
The entire amount of their debt. Yes,
right. If that's the case, then they didn't have to take into account the liens at all. Because there's a couple of different options. One is they bid the fair market value, and then they're supposed to subtract the amount of the water tap liens, right?
Right.
You're telling me that is not the option they took. They instead bid the full amount of their debt.
Right, they bid in the full amount of their debt. That's
which
what,
would not include the water tap liens.
Which well, would not necessarily take into consideration the water tap liens, but the redeeming party here had the opportunity to pursue a deficiency, and they seem to be arguing now that that's what they should have done, or that's what the court should have instructed the jury on. That's not what they were trying to do. They were trying to pursue a deficiency at trial. They were trying to recover the amounts that they paid 6 months after they became the owner of the property to satisfy these water tap liens. They did have the right to pursue a deficiency claim. They chose not to pursue a deficiency claim.
Who's the they in your
Walker? Excuse me. Walker Development, as the lender to Top Rail, had the right to pursue a deficiency claim. The value of the property and the amount that Walker Development had to apply to the debt that was owed by Top Rail to Walker Development was established on the day of the foreclosure sale. And what happened is Walker Development paid off that first deed of trust. They did not have to pay the extra amounts that were bid in by the third party. But the amounts that the third party bid under the Dicow case are presumptively the amount that they had to apply toward their debt and apply toward the debt that was owed by Top Rail. They couldn't take into consideration, they can't then pay amounts that they pay for these prior liens, which presumptively are taken into consideration when that third party makes that bid. Those are the amounts that can be applied, the amount of that bid is what is applied to the debt, but not
And that amount takes into consideration presumptively any prior debts and any everything else on the property. If there was an unfinished residence prior to the foreclosure sale, Walker Development could have come in and preserved that residence and made sure that under paragraph 9 of the deed of trust, it had a right to do that. But if it didn't do that prior to the foreclosure sale, it couldn't then charge Top Rail for those amounts if it did that afterwards, because whoever is bidding at the foreclosure sale takes into consideration that that residence hasn't been finished yet.
And why aren't all of these arguments ones that should be raised as a defense to the counterclaim once the counterclaim goes to trial? How do they get rid of the counterclaim? That's what I'm having trouble understanding, counsel.
Because Walker Development made a choice, even though they pled the promissory note and breach of the deed of trust and pled set off and did all these things. The only thing that they argued to the judge was that they had that they wanted the jury instructed on the amounts paid for these water tap liens, and that's inappropriate. The appropriate way to pursue this would have been the deficiency and the amount owed under the note, and that amount is established as of the date of the foreclosure sale. After you apply the amount that was bid at that foreclosure sale, less the amount that Walker Development had to pay to the first lender. That's what's established, and that's what has to be, and that's the claim that they should pursue. But that's not what they chose to do for whatever reason. They chose to pursue these water tap lien amounts, and that's improper. You once there's finality, once they become the owner of the property, there's finality on that day. And they can't seek amounts that they spend to finish a residence, to pay a property taxes, to pay insurance, to do anything after they've traded on day one prior to the foreclosure sale. They have a hat on there that they're a holder of the deed of trust, and they have the right to do anything they want to preserve their security interests. Once they're wearing the hat as the owner of the property, they no longer have the right to charge the borrower for amounts that they spend on the property that they now own.
Now, you won this issue as a matter of law because you got a directed verdict on it.
Yes.
What is the authority that says you win? What's the legal authority that says you win? You have a lot of factual arguments that you've given me.
Well, the Dykow case, for one, I understand.
DeCue, they pronounce it DeCue.
Oh, excuse me.
That's okay.
The DeCue case, Your Honor, says that the presumption is that that's where the value of the property is set. And also, once there's merger arguments, the deed of trust itself, there's no specific case on this issue that I'm aware of, and neither party has cited a specific case on this issue. But it's fundamental that there's finality when at the foreclosure sale, and a first deed of trust holder certainly couldn't pursue. Once the first deed of trust holder becomes the owner of the property, it can't pursue the borrower for anything. I mean, if you had a situation where there's a first deed of trust holder, there's a second deed of trust holder, and then there's a lien, there's a mechanics lien that has priority over both the first deed of trust and the second deed of trust, and this is a residence. The amount that's bid at the foreclosure sale is presumptively the amount that is going to take into consideration that mechanics lien. And because of that, once the whoever ends up owning that property, whether they have a deed of trust or not, once they become the owner of the property, they take that subject to the mechanics lien. And they can't go back and charge the borrower for that, even though they could have satisfied that prior to the foreclosure sale. And if they would have satisfied it prior to the foreclosure sale, the satisfaction of that lien would have been taken into consideration at the foreclosure sale, in the amount bid at the foreclosure sale.
You can move on, counsel, if you'd like. It's up to you.
With respect to the second appeal, case number 12 CA 1326, claim preclusion bars relitigation not only of all issues actually decided, but of all issues that might have been decided. Argus Real Estate
not Inc. might have or could have, and is there a difference
between might have and could have?
Yeah. Because the cases say could have, you said might have. I want to know whether that's just a slip of the tongue or whether there's some legal difference between those two.
I don't think that there is a legal difference, and I think
I don't either, but I was curious as to the choice of words.
Okay. And claim preclusion bars a litigant from splitting claims. Once judgment is entered in an action, it extinguishes the plaintiff's claim, including all rights of the plaintiff to remedies against the defendant with respect to all or any part of the transaction or series of connected transactions out of which the action arose. The arguably satisfied language that is that was referred to by the appellants, that was in connection with the argument that this case is different because there's an exception when you have a deed of trust and a debt. And what the court was saying is that exception doesn't apply in the situation such as this, where the debt has been arguably satisfied. And that is not a concession of that there are issues of fact here. It simply concedes that the fact that there was a foreclosure in the second action along with the pursuit of the debt doesn't change the fact that they were pursuing the debt and they were pursuing defenses and they were pursuing arguments regarding the debt in the first action, and that precluded them from doing so in the second action. In their briefing, Walker argues that the note and deed of trust were not at issue in the first lawsuit. But an examination of the counterclaim asserted by Walker Development in the first lawsuit shows that this is wrong. In the very first paragraph, the note and deed of trust that are the subject of the second lawsuit are referenced. In the second paragraph of the counterclaim, the August 2008 note that is the subject of the second lawsuit is referenced. The third paragraph discusses the water tap liens and the fact that the argument is that those constitute a violation of the deed of trust. The fifth paragraph of the counterclaim in the first lawsuit alleges that Top Rail and Mr. Jenkins defaulted on the note and deed of trust and that Walker redeemed at the foreclosure sale after such default. And the tenth paragraph ties the note and deed of trust to the contract for sale by claiming a right to attorney's fees based on the contract between Walker Development as seller of the real property and Top Rail and Jenkins as purchasers. If the note and deed of trust weren't at issue when Top Rail first filed its claim, they certainly became at issue once this counterclaim was filed. These are the same transactions or series of transactions that the second lawsuit relates to. And the wherefore clause of the counterclaim requests damages in an amount to be proven at trial. With respect to in the first lawsuit, Walker Development responded to discovery. And in those discovery responses, Walker Development justified its denial of allegations in the Top Rail complaint based on the alleged default by Top Rail
under the note and deed of trust. And in its answer to Top Rail's complaint, Walker Bowman asserted a defense of breach of contract. And when asked about this affirmative defense in discovery, Walker Bowman made it clear that this breach of contract affirmative defense related to Top Rail's alleged breach, alleged breach of the note and deed of trust. But that was the breach that they were referring to when they referred to Top Rail's breach of contract. Walker Development had an opportunity to fully and fairly litigate these issues. If it has an issue with respect to how the jury was instructed, those were issues that had to be raised in the first appeal. But they chose how to litigate that case for whatever reason in the first lawsuit. And the fact that the jury may not have been instructed on specific defenses, there were still arguments and closing arguments that the breach by Top Rail of the promissory note, if the jury found that there was a breach of the promissory note, that Top Rail couldn't recover under its claims.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. I want to thank both counsel for your excellent arguments. Case will stand submitted, and the bailiff can now.